Big thanks going out this week to Bad Joke Bespoke, Cynthia, Darren, and Michael, who became new patrons this week. All of them became new patrons this week. And to Robert, who increased their pledge amount this past week. You can join these awesome people, this growing group of fans, as we work towards goals of new content managers and podcast editors. You can help us reach that goal by signing up today, patreon.com/majorspoilers.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, updates for D&D, Moon Knight on D+, video game acquisitions, and a hero who'll save every one of us. We also check in with the latest in comic books, all brought to you in the mighty Major Spoilers fashion. It's a pop culture extravaganza, and we want you all to come along and listen. Go with us, because the Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome to the Major Spoilers Podcast, issue 960. 960 of these things over the last 10-plus years. We are certainly glad that you've been along with us for the ride as we get closer and closer every week to episode 1,000. Before we get to episode 1,000, though, we need to do some news.
All right. Are we, you guys, are we on the verge of a new edition of Dungeons & Dragons?
No!
Well, maybe. Wizards of the Coast has announced Monsters of the Multiverse, a new book that features 30 updated player character races, as well as 250 new monsters. The tome also has new stat blocks and methods for adding monsters to encounters, as well as streamlined rules for 5th edition. Unfortunately, if you want this book now, you'll have to buy the 3-book collection, which includes Xanathar's Guide to Everything, Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, and Monsters of the Multiverse for $169.99, I believe.
Jump fishhook.
If you want the standalone book, you'll need to wait until May 17th. And I believe Wizards maintains their, you know, we don't do PDFs rule as well.
Right. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. You can only get this in the hardcover. I'm sure it will have a variant cover that goes along with this. I believe originally they wanted this 3-book set to come out for the Christmas holiday time, but you know, supply chain things ruined that. I think it was a paper issue that ruined that. And this is kind of unfortunate because apparently this Monsters in the Multiverse contains all the updated character races in one location that have, you know, these character races have come out bits and pieces in a bunch of other books over the years, specifically Tasha's Cauldron of Everything. There are streamlined rules that have been sprinkled through other stuff. And then there's this new thing. I don't know if you read the Polygon article or if you read anything else about this, Rodrigo, but this monsters thing, these 250 new monsters, apparently you can either play it as is 5th edition, nothing's wrong with it, or you can go with this new way of doing your monsters and making that a little bit more encounter friendly, depending on how many people showed up to your encounter night. And so that sounds very interesting, too.
From what I understand, and please note that I have not played a game of 5th edition since Rob ran one for Critical Hit 1,000 years ago. But it is my understanding that challenge rating in 5th edition, which is something that D&D has kind of always had, or has had at least for several editions, was pretty busted. You know, monsters were more or less challenging than their challenge rating implied. So one of the things that they're doing is they're tweaking a bunch of monsters. They're keeping the challenge rating the same so that, for example, if you have an adventure that's like, sprinkle in some owlbears, like those owlbears, like if you sprinkle in the new owlbears, those will have been adjusted to function properly within that challenge rating. And the challenge rating basically means a party of 4 adventurers of that level. So challenge rating 10, 4 adventurers of level 10 is usually what it means. So this, they've basically said, is a soft transition into not 6th edition, but basically into something that's like 3.5 or the Essentials line in 4th edition. It's, you know, an update to things that is still supposed to be backwards compatible, although, you know, we'll see how true that is.
I find it very fascinating that they're being very tippy-toe-ish in saying what exactly this is. Is it a 5.5? Is it a 6.0? You know, basically they're saying, hey, if you want to play it the way that 5th edition was released, go ahead and do that. Or you could try this if you want. If you don't, no big deal. It's okay. And I guess they're trying to avoid people trying to jump into a edition war too early or too long about it. To which I say, hey, guess what, guys? If you enjoy 5th edition, play 5th edition. You don't have to buy any new stuff. You can still enjoy the stuff you like. If you want to play 3.5, go back and play 3.5. No one's going to some people will turn their nose down at you because you're not playing the latest greatest. But I think in this case, I find it odd that Wizards is just being very cautious in moving forward on this announcement.
Well, and it is, of course, just classic WotC to say, like, okay, here's the newest update. You need to buy two books that you already have to get it.
Right. And that's, and I think they wanted to do that because they wanted to, again, make it a gift set that was supposed to come out for the holiday. So if you had Monster Manual, Dungeon Master's Guide, Player's Guide, you could buy these other three books, upgrade the game and have, you know, a better playing experience, or streamline the game and have that better playing experience. But then they missed their holiday deadline, and they've already got all these prepackaged three book sets, and they don't want to break them up. So they're just like, okay, standalone book May. If you want it now, pay the $169, which, you know, I can understand why they're doing that. But at the same time, man, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be putting those Xanathar's Guide and Tasha's Cauldron at their used bookstore very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So Matthew, any thoughts?
Not really. I mean, I feel like, has Wizards of the Coast actually changed editions since they've owned the property? Was the 5e transition under Wizards?
Yeah, Wizards. So Wizards gained the property after second edition. So third edition was the first Wizards of the Coast property. Yeah.
Got it. And then they ruined it and we had to do 3.5. Okay. So yeah, I think Steven has a point. I think that they are trying to avoid the inevitable edition war as long as possible. But again, I'm also with Steven on the play what you want. I mean, you can go back and play AD&D.
I'm so excited. The base for Dungeons & Dragons has just grown so immensely because of streaming. Yeah. Just they went from, you know, it's increased 100-fold, 1,000-fold.
Yeah.
And I'm just so, like, so giddy about, like, all of these new players going through the hell that is
their first edition change.
Yeah. Like I feel like a cycle pump at the crossroads.
Do you think this is something that could then backfire dramatically on Wizards of the Coast in that, okay, we're going to, whether it's 5.5 or whether it's a 6.0, where you have literally billions of people who have invested in this game sitting there going, oh man, we don't want this. It's 5.0 or nothing. And then their whole system collapses because they've got this new edition that nobody wants to play.
So it's hard to tell, right? Because usually these sorts of things are kind of zero sum games.
Mm-hmm.
Your people who are playing Dungeons and Dragons 3rd edition, some of them don't want to go to 4th edition, so they go to Pathfinder. Some of them didn't want to play 5th edition, so they went to Pathfinder. Usually you just have like the same kind of handful of guys like in exchanging things, right? Kind of like in video games, you have your Xbox and your PlayStation, just kind of like people at each generation deciding which one they want. And then you have something like the Wii, which brings in a ton of new people. And these are not entrenched people, right? These are people that are brand new to all of it. And then, so you're like, oh yeah, all of these people are going to transition to the Wii U. And they definitely didn't, right? So I don't know. You know, again, streaming brought all of these new people into 5th edition. I don't know if the majority of them are going to go, okay, new edition, more books to buy, great. Or if they're going to be like, no, we're just going to go do something else, or we're going to stay with 5th edition, or we're done. Like, it's like, yay, D&D and D&D streaming was great. Bye. You know, it's like, I just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, let's all go check out this Fate thing that we've heard so much about. Surely there's a podcast somewhere that we can borrow ideas from. And we'll instead some of calling of... it Modern City, we will call it Modern City. Yeah, that'll show them. Anyway, Matthew, what's going on in the movie side?
Well, this Monday, if you were paying attention, Marvel Studios released the latest trailer for the upcoming Disney Plus series, Moon Knight. If you don't know, Moon Knight is an ex-soldier with what I consider to be the comic book version of dissociative identity disorder, which manifests as fully distinct individuals. But he's also being played by Oscar Isaac, Poe Dameron, and apparently in everything. I've seen like three movies that I know I'd seen that I did not recognize him in.
Yeah.
I watched Ex Machina the other night, and I'm like, that's Oscar Isaac.
Yep.
How did I not know? But
he's
in any case,
he's an Annihilation too. He's Apocalypse
Under the Purple. Oh, that's weird.
Yep, that's him.
Well, Oscar and or Mark then become the conduit for an Egyptian moon god Khonshu, or maybe not. Maybe it's just another personality. We don't know. But in any case, it's going to exacerbate Mark's anxiety over his mental illness. It's actually supposed to start March 30th of this year on the D+, and
I think that's the thing that everybody was waiting for, not necessarily the new trailer, but when was this going to drop on Disney Plus? And I think knowing that it's sooner rather than later makes everybody fairly happy. What about you, Rodrigo?
Yeah, I'm interested in it. I'm worried about it because, you know, anything that deals with like legit, mental illness just has walking a razor's edge, right? And could very easily fall into one of a thousand pitfalls, right? Into being like, oh, well, people with mental illness are magic, or people with mental illness should need to get off their pills and that'll make them feel better. And it's like, it's just, there's just all of these terrible tropes that surround it. And to take a character from what, the 70s, back when all of these tropes were like perfectly legit things that you could do, and trying to bring it now is going to be difficult, you know, for about three episodes. That terrible Iron Fist show tried to do the whole like, actually, you're not Iron Fist, you're in a mental institution, before they bailed on it. Good or bad, it's just impossible to tell what was going on in that show. But they didn't do a great job of that. So I'm interested. You know, Oscar Isaac does a great job. You know, your Latinx representation, I'm happy about it. Moon Knight is a cool character. Again, what a world to live in where there's a Moon Knight TV show. Right. But I'm going to just clench until that finally comes out and I get to see the first episode and I see how they play it.
Yeah. There's a lot of room for missteps. And honestly, aside from that, you know, real life mental illness problem that they have, they also have the issue where so many people online, and this is literally what I keep hearing over and over and over, they're doing the series of Moon Knight. Who's Moon Knight, you say? Well, my explainer will tell you all about Marvel's Batman. And I'm like, no, stop. Stop trying to make Moon Knight Batman. But I'm also
Marvel already did that 20 years ago, so knock it off. Anyway, here's a surprise that took the gaming industry by storm today. Microsoft is in the process of acquiring Activision Blizzard. The deal is reportedly costing Microsoft a cool $68.7 billion. And not only $1 billion, this is cash, a cash transaction, meaning no stock options, none of that stuff. Microsoft just opened up their wallet and said, here's $68.7 billion. And in return, Microsoft gets all of the Blizzard properties, including Overwatch, World of Warcraft, Hearthstone, and all the Activision stuff, including Call of Duty and Candy Crush and all that other Activision stuff. No word from Sony if Overwatch will be removed from their system when the transaction is complete. What do you think, Rodrigo?
Yeah, so I was talking to some people about it today, and I was talking to some I guess kind of normies, and they were like, "Why? Yeah, they're like, yeah, this is good. Good, this is gonna be good, right?" And I'm like, "No." My wife was talking to them too, and she's like, "No, Monopoly bad guys." you know, Overwatch 2, which is coming out, I don't remember what's coming out, but it's been in the works for a long time, is probably still going to come out for PlayStation. My guess is this is going to affect games that aren't already in the hopper, right? Games that aren't already slated or whatever. You're going to start seeing Microsoft basically try to, it's like, if Microsoft can't beat Sony at having enough originals, it will consume and possibly destroy every studio until there is nothing left but Microsoft and Sony. Which is also one of the things that I talked to them about. I'm like, there's a long history of Microsoft, of lots of companies, actually of Activision, for that matter, acquiring companies, like acquiring young, good, up-and-coming companies that have produced good games, and then shuttering them, basically maybe getting them through one more release and then being like, this isn't making enough money for us, so let's close down the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've seen it. You've seen that done with tons of stuff. Was it Lionsgate? Is it Lionsgate? Like the guys that were doing Fable, right? It's like everybody loved Fable, and then Microsoft acquired them, and then now that studio is just, there's just a hole in the ground where that studio used to be, right? Probably the hole in the ground that Microsoft was keeping that $68 billion in. So this is, you know, it's worrisome in the sense that if these, you know, if you were hoping for a new Lost Vikings video game,
that's what I'm waiting for.
Get it.
Oh man, I figured Bill Gates would be like, listen, I need a Lost Vikings. I'm buying Activision Blizzard so I can get a new Lost Vikings title.
When it's like Blizzard was barely doing Lost Vikings stuff, right? And then Activision acquired them. I think the last Lost Vikings was like in Heroes of the Storm.
Mm-hmm.
Activision acquires them and is like, well, you know, obviously the Lost Vikings here is a metaphor for anything that you might like from Blizzard. And then Microsoft eats that, you know, and of course this comes in the heels of a huge scandal of sexual harassment at Blizzard Activision. And it's like the Activision guys were like, let's change the news cycle and sell. So now this has taken over. I guess the big asterisk here is that so many people got angry at Activision Blizzard that they stopped playing World of Warcraft and started playing Final Fantasy 15. Mm-hmm. So much so that they like absolutely crashed that game. Like so many people transitioned over that Final Fantasy had to like put a hard stop on all of their advertisement. They're like, we're not going to advertise Final Fantasy 15 anymore. We literally have so many people trying to get in. We never need to advertise this game again. So it's
that
like,
was, I guess one of my questions was, is will, I don't know what the environment is at Microsoft. I'm assuming that it's maybe a little bit better than what was going on at Activision, but at the very least, if this knocks out some of the sexual harassment and sexual assault stuff that was going on at Activision, then yeah, the sale is good. If it can maybe, polish up some of the bad taste in people's mouths.
I would hope that is upfront on Microsoft's plate, right?
Yeah.
Like they're like, okay. Yeah. We'll merge things. And of course there will be mass firings, but first let's just clean this out, right? Let's investigate it. Let's come down with as hard a hammer as we can on whoever needs to be hammered in the head. And then we'll get to the business of the merger, which is to, you know, give your IPs to a studio in Scotland and see if they, can finish the game.
We are going to get a Halo version of Hearthstone. It's going to be a Halo Stone, and it's going to feature all your favorite Master Chief and Cortana characters in the Hearthstone skin. And there you go. It'll be $9.99 a month plus $20 per pack.
Wizards of the Coast is already doing this, right? You've heard about the announcement that Magic the Gathering is going to have like a Lord of the Rings expansion and a like Warhammer expansion. So it's like, sure, let's just mix everything with everything.
Listeners, you can join the conversation about these stories and more over on our Discord server. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free. There's a link in your show notes. Or if you're one of our fine patrons over at patreon.com/majorspoilers, simply link your Patreon account to our Discord server and you get access to even more channels. You can find out how to do that over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Going to get into some reviews this week. We've got a lot of them. Matthew, what's going on over in the world of Spawn? Yes.
Sorry, quick correction. Final Fantasy 14 is the MMO. I believe Final Fantasy 15 is the one where you're a boy band in a car.
Oh, okay. We've got that cleared off. Right.
Final Fantasy du jour.
Yes. Matthew, what's going on with King Spawn over at the Image Comics?
King Spawn. Now, if you are a Spawn fan, hi. How are you? My name's Matthew. Never have been, but I can definitely understand it. King Spawn number 6, written by Sean Lewis, art by Javi Fernandez, is the story of original recipe, old school Albert Simmons, a giant cape covered in chains Spawn. And in the first few issues, he was dealing with a new awful guy called the Disruptor. And at the end of last issue, we found out who the Disruptor actually is. And I have to admit, it is a surprise reveal that worked for me, because the Disruptor turns out to be Martin Sheen. Or rather, the character that Martin Sheen played in the Spawn movie back in 1997. What's his name? Wynn? Jason Wynn? Yeah, Jason Wynn. The original Spawn villain from issue 1 back in the Pleistocene era. So as this issue opens, Al Simmons, the King Spawn, who is the kingiest of all the Spawns, is being captured. We get a nice flashback on what happened to Wynn, how he ended up in HE Double Hockey Sticks, how he got out of HE Double Hockey Sticks, and how he is now the Disruptor. But I also want to point out something wonderful about this particular issue. Every time Al uses his powers, even though there's no longer an old school counter, he looks like Venom. His suit does things just like Venom. So there's a point where he literally raises up his hand and his suit kind of leaps off and attacks. Also, he's got a skull for a face. But throughout this issue, we get to see a little bit of Al. We see Terry Fitzgerald, who was Al's best friend a million years ago. So if you've read the first 25 issues of Spawn and are looking to get back into Spawn and looking for an easy step-in point, I feel like the first 6 issues of King Spawn, this arc and the way it ends, are probably the way to do it. Because there are references in here to Spawn's daughter. I don't know if you know about Spawn having a daughter. In one universe, she was a superhero. But it also ends with sort of a resolution of the Spawn and Jason Wynn thing, but also a newer, bigger threat waiting in the wings, which I think is kind of neat. And it introduces a concept that I'm not going to spoiler for you, but if you look at the last page of the story, you'll know exactly, oh my gosh, this is kind of cool. And it ties perfectly into the, 30 years of spontaneity that we have so far. The real star, though, is the art of Javi Fernandez, because I looked at the cover. This issue's cover is actually painted and is a completely different style than what you get interior. But once you get into this book, it's really lovely. And you keep seeing, you know, close-ups of Spawn's face, where it's not just Spawn, you know, with the eyes and the mouth and the thing, you know, his pseudo Spider-Man face. He's a skull upon which there's a thin layer of what looks like flesh, but actually shows that Spider-Man face. So the harder he fights and the more he's twisted out, the more you get of the skull aspect. And it's really neat. And honestly, if Spawn had looked like this in 1993, I might have stuck with Spawn for the whole run. It's really, really good. It is graphic. It is gross. There is some impalement. There's some injury to the eye. It definitely would not pass the original comics code. But it's not a bad book. And also, Stephen, for your perusal, it's $2.99.
Yeah, still going to pass. Sorry.
I'm just saying, you know, you've been saying for a long time that a good way to get books to more eyes would be to make them cheaper.
And I think McFarlane is onto something now. Again, he didn't do this book, except that he is everything Image and he is everything Spawn. But right. I think McFarlane, I think he understands that. One of his Spawn books recently, you know, broke some sales record. And again, that's direct sales market, so I don't know.
Sure.
So, you know, he may be onto something in doing what I've said is drop your books by a whole buck comic industry and you'll sell more and you will have more attraction to it. So, yes, I'm totally down for this being a $2.99 book. I think that's great. I applaud Image Comics for that. I'm just not interested in Spawn. I mean, when it first came out, it was that slick paper and the color and the the craziness of what was going on in Spawn that had me buying those first 25 issues. But rarely did I really read it more than just looking at the art just because it was so freaking pretty. I just don't get into that character. So, hey, but if you're a fan, go grab it. $2.99. Go grab two copies. It'll still be cheaper than some of the other comics that are out on the market today. So there you go.
Yep.
All right. Three slices of meatloaf for that. Also out this week from Boom Studios, it's Angel number one. Now, Dark Horse originally had the Buffy the Vampire Slayer property really all the way back to 1998, but really got a big boost in 2007 when it started doing its season 8 through 13 or however many seasons they had continuing on to that story. And then in 2018, they lost the Buffy property. It went over to Boom Studios. This is probably right around the same time that a lot of the certain director of the series got into a lot of trouble and all the stuff, horrible things came out about him, even going on in this week. And so Boom Studios, when they were doing it, they kind of approached their Buffy the Vampire Slayer in a different way in that, yes, it's Buffy and the Scooby Gang, and we're telling stuff in Sunnyvale, but we're twisting those stories that you know just enough and taking them into a different direction to the point where a lot of people started to think, wait a minute, is this taking place in a different universe? And of course we have Old Lady Buffy or whatever the current series is, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where she's a 50-year-old Buffy. And then we get Angel number one, and Angel number one, you know, basically confirms something that we've already known, is that there is a Buffy multiverse. So if you want to be a Whedon fan and you want to, you know, think that all the stuff that Dark Horse did was still in continuity and is your Buffy, that's great. But if you want a different take on these same characters, then you have this new Buffyverse. Well, Angel takes place in yet another universe in which somebody has come through. I'm not really sure who it is. Somebody has come through and they're looking for Angel in Los Angeles, and they stumble upon somebody's apartment where they're playing Angel for Hire, the detective television show that is a huge hit that's starring Angel and his co-star Cordelia. And wait a minute, what's going on? Why is there a detective drama show starring Angel and Cordelia in this real world? Well, we soon find out that yes, during the quote unquote day, Angel and Cordy are actors on this very popular television show. But by night, he's back at the hotel with all of the Angel gang doing Angel investigations and going out and doing monster hunting. So what was the green demon's name? Lorne. Lorne is there. Fred is the current vampire slayer in this universe. Wesley is her watcher. They go out trying to take down a mummy and he gets critically wounded. And of course, Angel is out doing celebrity stuff. So that causes a big riff with everyone at Angel Investigations. And there's a lot of them. I was really surprised that I kind of forgot over the years how many people were part of Angel's team, because you do have Spike is part of the team. Fred, Wesley, Lorne, and there's one other, person.
There's like that tall, like black dude, right? It's like a
gun. He's not in this yet. But there's a nerdy character who I don't remember what his name is off the top of my head. But so it's really interesting to see this different take on Angel and crew, and Wesley may die or not die in this, and Angel may be not in this world by the end of the issue. It is really trippy to think of everything that you may have known from the television series or the Dark Horse comics, and then seeing Boom twist it on its head, thanks to Christopher Cantwell and Daniel Bayless, who's doing the art on this. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I think some people are going to still be too much of a purist on what the Angel television show was or what the Buffy the Vampire main television universe was about to really want to wrap their heads around an all new Angel and gang in this world. But I think it'll come out okay by the end. I enjoyed it enough that I want to read the next issue. 3.5 slices of meatloaf for me for Angel number one out this week from Boom Studios. Art good, story very solid. I think that if you are someone who's a fan of a multiverse like I am, then I think that you will get a kick out of what Boom is trying to do to keep the Buffy franchise alive in these ever changing times. So there you go. Rodrigo, we're jumping ahead a couple of weeks to, is this a trade paperback? Is this a first issue? What is this?
Oh no, I'm sorry. This is a first issue.
Okay. All right.
Speed Republic number one from Matt Cave, right? You guys know Matt Cave mm-hmm. Studios. Yep. We've done yep. stuff from there before. Mm-hmm. So
Matt
this
Cave
is
and the Bad Seeds. I love their work.
This is Ryan Lindsay, artist or art by Emmanuel Parascandolo. So the premise here is that Europe, it is, you know, it still feels like modern times. Nothing feels too advanced, but maybe in the not too distant future, Europe has been unified, and not in a good way. And the supreme leader is called, I suppose, very appropriately, the autocrat. One of the things that happens now is a Circus Maximus kind of a thing with a mad race across the entirety of Europe. So nice. The main character starts in... I don't remember, but they end up in Paris in the first, in the first leg of the race. We find out that they kind of have checkpoints set up and places where there's kind of like a no fighting type rule. But other than that, you're kind of allowed to do almost anything to get ahead. So it's kind of a death race feel, but it's like so, yeah, it's like the distances are so long that there are like times when like you might not see another car for a while. The artist's good. I enjoy it. The characters are very expressive. It's very colorful. This is a book that has cars. It's a book about a car race. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate what Parascandolo does with cars. Like, you can tell which car is which. They're not necessarily super similar. Obviously, to me, all cars pretty much look alike. But where I'm like, okay, which one's the protagonist car and stuff? Like, I mean, it helps that, you know, cars tend to be like different colors that are mm-hmm. like in a single scene. But mm-hmm. but cars look good, right? It's like this is a thing about cars. It's like it's a thing about young people driving cars. Do the young people look good? Yes. The cars look good? Yes. So that's like the minimum you need out of this art, and it's actually doing a very good job of both. As far as the story, we're following this one character. We get a flashback of what his life was like leading up to this. It's interesting. It doesn't really grab me. It's, you know, kind of this, it's like a dystopia where like there's like a blood sport that people do. You know, it's like it's a little bit Running Man, it's a little bit Battle Royale, it's a little bit Hunger Games. But other than people kind of telling you stuff, you don't really see it too much. It's like the race itself is full of like scary people. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's hard to tell. I mean, you know, maybe that's what the author is saying is you know, and you find yourself living in a dystopia, and it actually doesn't look anything different from before. It's like, what am I doing? What is happening to this country? Anyway, I'm going to give it 3 slices of meatloaf. I think it was, it's good. You know, it's above average. It has an interesting, like an interesting reveal at the end. So yeah, I'd say, yeah, if you're into cars and dystopian stuff, check it out.
Does Captain Chaos show up in this?
Captain Chaos does not show up in this, but there is a guy. There is a guy wearing a pug mask that gets run over. So,
okay. All right. So there you go. Speed Republic number one. I couldn't find a link over on our Amazon affiliate link for the first issue, but I did find a link to the trade paperback that comes out in August. Anybody is interested in pre-ordering that now. Certainly, we have affiliate links through Comixology and Amazon. So if you do make any of the purchases of these comics that we have listed in our show links, you're not going to get charged anything more. You're not going to get charged anything extra, but a little bit, and I mean a little bit, comes back our way. And I know some of you have been using the Amazon affiliate links for some of these single issues regularly through our reviews that we have on the Major Spoilers website and other places. Certainly appreciate all of the effort that you guys are doing. And a question that I do get quite a bit is, what if I use your link that you have on the majorspoilers.com website to the Amazon store? What happens if I want to buy something that's not comic books? What happens if I want to buy a record? Or what happens if I want to buy a computer? Or what happens if I want to buy a large screen TV? Do you guys also get a portion of that? Yes, we also get a portion of those sales, providing you're going through the link over at majorspoilers.com. So yeah, thanks a lot for everybody for all the purchasing that you've made in 2020 and 2021. Certainly it's kept Amazon alive, and it's, of course, forced Jeff Bezos to give us a little bit in return. It's on you, Jeff Bezos. next week, we'll all be riding in our own Amazon branded cars across Europe. So there you go.
Across the wastelands as we fight. Yes. I want the guy with the flamethrower on my car, please.
I want a Jackie Chan as my co-pilot. So, here's the thing. I want to apologize to Rodrigo Lopez, first and foremost, as we crack open the very first page of Flash Gordon and the Death Planet. This is Flash Gordon from 1967.
67. Yeah.
And it opens up with Flash Gordon's new sidekick, Poncho.
Yep.
As they go to the planet Pluto. And this whole volume. Now, of course, we go back historically. Flash Gordon was kind of the counter to Buck Rogers. Buck Rogers came out first. Then Flash Gordon, King Syndicate's trying to capitalize on the Buck Rogers fame, so they created Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon has become very popular and very famous. You know, the movie from the 1980s, everybody still quotes. That's probably how most people were introduced to Queen, through that soundtrack. Flash Gordon was in his initial trips fighting Ming the Merciless, which was a kind of a bad caricature of the Asian peoples. And
like a yellow peril villain with like science fiction trappings on it.
Yeah. And so that was not bad, but that was not good. But it just seemed to continue. We get to 1967 and we get to Poncho, who is wearing a sombrero in space, thick accent. There's an episode where they're being controlled, mind controlled or something, where they're being presented with, your greatest fantasy.
Like illusions.
Yeah. And Poncho has these two Mexican women, dressed up in their traditional garb, fawning over him. And it's really just a bad take. And it goes on from there. There's seriously some Russian, versions of villains in this book that talk with the heavy accent. And so I think Flash Gordon and the Death Planet, and maybe just Flash Gordon in general, rides a weird, straddles a thin line between racially insensitive and Cold War bigotry, I think is how I would sum up this book. And I don't know what your thoughts were, Rodrigo, because I didn't know that Poncho was the first thing we were going to see in this comic.
Yeah, and it really is the very first thing you see. It's like, Yeah, so it's, I guess it's nice to see Pancho and be able to point at it, right? Because when you're like, okay, what are some like really over the top Mexican stereotypes? There's obviously something like Speedy Gonzalez, but Speedy Gonzalez is obviously is kind of like weirdly muddied by the fact that he's a mouse and he has superpowers, right? Mm-hmm, so it's like, right.
And he fights the bad cat,
and he fights the gringo pussycat. So it's, yeah, so again, it's like, you know, a lot of Mexican people from Mexico actually really like Speedy Gonzalez. So
his cousin Slowpoke?
Yeah, is again, because it exists in this thing where it's like Speedy's very fast and this guy's very slow. Like, it doesn't, like, to Mexicans, it doesn't seem like a stereotype. I think really that becomes much more of a stereotype when you look at it from the American perspective. But if you look at Pancho, like, Pancho is just so lazy.
Doesn't he have like a serape or something that he wears in space?
So he doesn't. So okay, let's do right by Pancho, because I read this whole Pancho arc. So Pancho is from Mexico, something that he reminds you very often. But he does wear a spacesuit, and then later on when a guy who literally looks like the 80s cartoon Dungeon Master turns their fantasies into reality, both Flash's and Pancho's, Flash is wearing like this like really, I don't know, like Frazetta-ish, I want to say. Outfit to like fight a dragon, like Prince Valiant, more like Prince Valiant. Outfit, and Pancho ends up with like a little serape and a sombrero, which, you know, it's like people do wear that. Again, kind of an asterisk on that is like he is wearing that in space, but like the bad guys put it on him, so it's weird. That's just an offsides, right? It's like it's hard to say if it's actually a point against. The real problem with Pancho is that he is meant to be a comedy character, an exposition character who gets exposition to us by not knowing things, right? Unfortunately, he is a very lazily written stereotype to the point where his accent changes. From panel to panel, right? So, for example, in his very first line is, "Si, Señor Flash, but maybe Pancho help you rescue lost crew on Pluto," right? So he's dropping articles. He's referring to himself in the third person, which is not a Mexican thing. I think maybe Pancho's an orc. so it's like, again, just like at every turn, Pancho is just, again, just feels like a very lazy caricature. The next time, like literally the next page, we see Pancho, they're landing on Pluto and it's an icy planet. And Pancho's like, "Brr, that looks nothing like my Mexico down there." And it's like, except of course, in Mexico's two major mountain ranges where, you know, like it snows all the time. You know, it's like, "Oh, I've never seen snow because I live in like, I guess, the opening 30 minutes of the Three Amigos." You know, it's like, that's kind of the problem, right? It's like very lazy, just kind of character that's there for jokes and for exposition, right? It's like, when you get into it, Pancho saves Flash a few times from peril. Pancho actually holds his own in a fight. It's like, weirdly, you see this character like vaguely start morphing into an actual character, and then, you know, immediately they have him open his mouth and say something terrible, or not terrible, but just like obnoxious. You know, it's like the very last moment that we see Pancho, I don't know if he comes back later, I didn't get all the way through this, but in this first arc, it's one of the things that happens is they the aliens give them their heart's desire, right? It's like Flash Gordon gets to fight a dragon and Pancho gets to like hang out with some senoritas. And then at the end, so the senoritas are like illusion robots. And like at the end, they're like flying away from the planet. And Flash realizes that Pancho has brought one of them along. And he's like, Pancho, you know, she's a robot. And he's like, oh, yeah, Senor Flash. But where else are you going to find a woman who doesn't talk back? You know? And I'm like, oh, my Lord. Just like...
And there's that kind of stuff that happens throughout the story, too, right? I mean, Flash kind of treats Dale kind of that way, too. Oh, you silly woman kind of moments that flip through this, which is really odd because, you know, especially with the sexism part of it, is that we're the 1960s through the 70s, you know, the women's liberation movement is going on at this time, that you would think, hope that a little bit of that would translate to the page, but maybe not in this case. Which is sad.
Flash Gordon always feels very old school. When you're like, oh yeah, this is from the 60s. It's like, what? Seriously? From like the 60s and 70s? This feels like it's from the 50s.
That was my thing too. I didn't realize that Flash Gordon actually went this long. I'm like, 70s Flash Gordon? What?
If you look in the opening pages, they have kind of like a, not a discography, but they have a rundown of every single Flash Gordon story, all the way to, I want to say like the 1990s or something like that. When, you know, in the papers, that the newspaper strip went, let me see here if I can find, let's see. Sunday, 2003 is when the, Sunday strips ended.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's fairly recent on a lot of this stuff. Here's the thing that I think is really, really weird. So when Buck Rogers started and when Flash Gordon started in 1934, Buck Rogers in 1928. In 1934, the idea of what the future was going to be was very different from the 1960s version of what the future was going to be. So when we look at the original comic strips from the 1930s, we see, you know, these spaceships that are all Art Deco and, you know, blasting through space and ray guns and jetpacks and all of this stuff. And we know that that is the 1930s take on what the future would be like. And we know by 1960 that that is definitely not what the future is like. And yet that's where we get some weird retrofuturism going in this comic, because Flash Gordon still flies around in a spaceship that looks like his 1930s spaceship.
Like a Professor Rocket kind of thing.
Yeah. Professor Zarkov or whatever his name is the same way. You know, all of his technology looks like stuff from the 1930s, except every other spaceship looks like a 1960s version of what the future would look like. And then as we start to introduce and know more about the space program and what NASA is doing, and what the Mercury pilots are wearing, suddenly everyone in this comic in the 1960s, the book that we're reviewing, The Death Planet, are all wearing like Mercury 7 astronaut suits. Yet they're flying around in these Art Deco retro futurism spaceships. And it's just something that I cannot wrap my head around in this book. It doesn't fit. It feels ridiculous. I think in the intro, they also talk a little bit about how Flash Gordon was initially in his adventures with Ming the Merciless, more fantasy based, you know? So when we see, Flash Gordon fighting the dragon sequence in the Pluto, segment, that's very much like what Flash Gordon would have been like in the 1930s. But then once you get Harry Harrison and Dan Barry, and especially Dan Barry through these strips, they wanted to make it feel more modern. And so we get this weird clash of past and present versions of space mixed together. And it just does not work, at least for me. I don't know what you think, Matthew, but I just looked at the clash of art and technology in this and it was just like, nope, I'm out.
I actually agree with you. I feel like when I picked this up and I was like, okay, what are we looking at? Flash Gordon. Okay. I'm thinking 1946. And then all of a sudden it's dated 1968. I'm like, honestly, I did not think about or realize that Flash Gordon would have been around in 1968. And so seeing these stories where you have this early 20th century kind of ethos going on at a time when people are literally going to the moon or trying to go to the moon, it really feels awkward. And, you know, Flash Gordon is supposed to be sort of futury, but not in the, I don't even know if they're in the future. You know, Buck Rogers came back in the 25th century. That makes sense.
Yeah, that one is definitely in the future. There's not really, I don't think that in the original, well, I guess in the original Flash Gordon, he is flying a biplane and stuff when the planet Mongo comes into, or it's, you know, in the novel When Worlds Collide in 1933, you've got this other planet coming into it. So maybe, maybe this is, you know, the 1930s. I mean, it's still retrofuturism in the 1960s when you're using designs from the 1930s. It's just, it doesn't.
Yeah, it causes, definitely, you have that kind of a collision of thought processes, and it causes some, what do you call it?
Have a name for that.
Yeah, what is it? Cognitive dissonance.
Universe expansion dissonance.
And, you know, that's definitely a good point, too. As you look at this, Otter used to refer to it as the power creep, where you have to keep one-upping yourself. You have to keep going a step beyond what you did before, and eventually the Flash runs 15 times the speed of light. And this story, I think, definitely suffers from that, because I did get all the way through it. And honestly, I am a huge fan of Macro Boy's art. And I feel like I would not have gotten through this if the first arc wasn't all Raboy, where I could look at this and go, gosh, that's pretty. I sure wish it was bigger, but gosh, that's pretty. You know, it comes to a point for me where it feels like, first of all, I'm 50, 45, 50 years beyond when this was being presented. And at the time that this was being presented, you know, if I'm thinking of similar media from 1968, 69, 70, I'm thinking of things like that first Planet of the Apes movie came out around that time. This feels like, this is like retrograde science fiction for the era in which it came out. And then you add another half century to when we're reading it. And I'm just like, had this not been pretty, I don't think I would have gotten through it.
I think the Macro Boy art is only the very first one, the Pluto stuff, because he died in 67. So everything else is Dan Barry in this strip. I think it's the Pluto story, and it may actually, you have to go read the front matter in this. And that's one of the nice things that I like about these collected editions, is that they have interviews and retrospectives and telling you what's going on. Yeah. It may be that Raboy only did the very first strip in this collection before he passed away. And then Dan
Raboy did most of the first Pluto strip with Poncho. He didn't get to the end of it. And I think Raboy died in like 1969. I can't remember.
Well, no, exactly, he died in 67. Like I said, a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, the art is neat. It's interesting. Here's the one thing that I like doing is flipping through the pages very, very quickly. Each arc, the Flash Gordon title changes. So, you know, you're in a different arc based on the art that says Flash Gordon in the upper left panel. The other thing is there are only slight variations in panel size throughout this entire book. If you flip through it very fast, you'll notice that it is square Flash Gordon title, long panel at the top, and then followed by kind of a narrow panel. And then underneath that, it's you know, I forget what the layout is. I don't have it here in front of me. But that pattern of the panel layout is the same day in and day out through this entire volume. And save for just a few width changes here and there, everything is consistent in that layout, which I found very, very fascinating from a layout art perspective. But from story perspective, no, pass.
Yeah, they definitely had the layout down to a science. And I think that probably helped both artists and writers.
Mm-hmm. Especially when this went to a daily. This went from a Sunday-only strip to a daily strip in the 1940s, I want to say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, I don't know. This one is called the Death Planet because I forget the reason why. They go to a planet and it's run by robots or something, or maybe that's the last story that I'm conflating it with. I didn't find any of the stories fascinating at all. I'm sorry. I thought that they were all boring. I thought that there was nothing ingenious in here. I didn't find anything even slightly attractive in here as far as the story goes. I just thought it was the worst. I wish we would have been able to get our hands on one of the collected first volumes of Flash Gordon, because I think we may have had a different take on this. But I just found this to be no thank you, boring. Please let me finish this as fast as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you thought, Matthew, on this, but this is one that I would definitely pass on.
My biggest complaint was the presentation, because, you know, as you mentioned, each strip does have pretty much the same format, but for some reason they have massive wide borders around it. And I feel like there's room to expand the reprinting to get maybe some more detail in the art. I know that when you're doing a book like this and you're making part of a series, you want to have consistency in the volume so they're the same size. So, you know, having three daily strips in a page mm-hmm. this size is one thing, but doing one Sunday strip, it still feels like you could have actually blown this up more. I feel like, first of all, the Death Planet thing bugs me because there's a Flash Gordon movie, Flash Gordon and the Planet of Death. But if you look through this entire chapter, there are three chapters that take place on Pluto. And I think the Planet of Death is the one with the robots, where only robots. And, you know, basically there's a character there who's basically Harry Mudd in that episode of Star Trek, you may recall. When the second Mudd episode, he showed up and he was living with the identical androids. I feel like that story is literally the robot world arc of Flash Gordon, which also kinds of bugs me. But I feel like that you have a line between a campy story, which is what I might expect from 1967 to 1971, something that's like tongue in cheek or maybe blowing up bits and pieces of the Flash Gordon mythos to make it a little funnier or to, you know, point at some of the things that no longer work. But this doesn't feel campy. This feels like it's done straightforward. And yet somehow I still have the same feeling of it's pointing out some of the problems and the flaws with the Flash Gordon concept in a larger kind of thought process. And that really bothers me when a story or a storyteller seems to be undermining what they're actually doing. You know,
well, it
feels
and
like
that's
this volume.
So again, I think it's in one of the early matters, or maybe I read it somewhere. When Harrison left the strip, he was very much making this as much fantasy as possible. And then when Barry took over, he wanted to make it more science as possible. And that's why, you know, you see the dragon bit and you're like, oh, okay, there's a little fantasy stuff. But the rest of the stuff is just straight up robots, aliens, space kidnappings, all that stuff. Right. And so it's, you know, there is that shift away from what maybe at this time period, older readers would look at and say, well, this isn't my Flash Gordon. My Flash Gordon, he was fighting dragons in space, where this one is just definitely like he's fighting robots in space.
Thank you, Flash Gordon, for being part of the wave that sort of hardened sci-fi so that Star Wars could come in and just like kick the bucket out from everybody.
Yeah, bring fantasy back. Yeah.
That George Lucas quote is on the back cover where he's like, I just wanted to make a Flash Gordon serial and I ended up having to make Star Wars. And I'm like, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. He couldn't get the rights. They wouldn't give him the rights to do it. And so he's like, okay, I'll just do this. Rodrigo, what are your thoughts on this? You hate it? Is it the worst thing that you've ever read? Is it the, you know, what are your thoughts?
So at various times, it's like, you know, racist and misogynistic and stuff. So it's hard to walk up to where this piece lives and take it on, you know, on its own terms.
Yeah.
But if you try, it's still kind of not great. And I think there's a lot of things working against it. I think, you know, that strict format, sometimes you had something where that could be three panels, but they have to expand it to like nine panels, you know, because it needs to fit a whole strip because you don't want to do the next thing with only the last three panels. It has to be its own thing. So stories move at a crawl. There's tons of dialogue that probably doesn't need to be there. Again, you know, you have a guy wearing a spacesuit with a sombrero on top of it. It's tough. Like this book makes it very tough for a modern audience to, again, to get to it, to be on its own terms. So it's a pass for me, definitely.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the weird things, right? Because I've been trying to get us to read some of these classic comics. I mean, you know, comic books as we know them today started in the newspapers and these collected editions of the newspaper strips being turned into comics and then, you know, going from there. And now we've got access to, thanks to preservation, thanks to people who've collected and saved the original art, we can go back and read a lot of these newspaper strips from, you know, 60 years ago, 100 years ago, and kind of get an idea for what it would have been like to, you know, sit down with the Sunday section of the comics and not read, you know, High and Lois or Beetle Bailey or Family Circus, but to read something that like a Tarzan or a Flash Gordon or a Prince Valiant, you know, or a Mandrake the Magician. And every time we come across one of these collections, I'm like, ooh, this would be really interesting. And then I get to it, I'm like, holy crap, this is not this nostalgia factor that I was hoping it would be.
It's really, so this happens a lot, right? And it happens a lot to us living today in the world of 2022 or whenever you're listening to it. Hello, future people. Where you sit down and you're like, oh man, I remember Friends. And now Friends is on like Netflix or whatever. And you sit down and you start binging Friends and you're like, wow, every episode of this is the same. These characters are obnoxious. And half the jokes are just a brief intimation of homosexuality. No joke. And then everybody laughs, right? It's like,
yeah.
And it's seeing so much of it together shows you that it's very formulaic, that it's maybe not as funny as you thought. You know, it's funny at first, but when they keep doing the same stuff, it's not as funny. It's like, so seeing these serialized works, if you were like a kid in the 60s and you were desperate for your dad to stop reading the newspaper so you could look at the funnies and see the next, you know, Flash Gordon or Mandrake or Da Phantom or whatever, then yeah, you know, I'm sure each instance was exhilarating. But when you see them all together, you see them vamping for time. You see them retreading stuff that's already happened. You see them stretch a scene over so much time just because it doesn't, like, they needed to work into a certain rubric or, you know, or they ran out of ideas or whatever. You know, it's like, a lot of the time I felt like there was a lot of stalling in this.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of what ends up happening when you take something that was serialized and you watch it all at once.
Well, and I think that's also part of that where it feels like it's drawn out is also, or feels rushed or just doesn't feel like it's well thought out is because they're working in this case, all the Sunday strips, they're trying to get this out on a weekly basis, or in the case of the daily strips, getting this stuff out on a daily basis. So, you know, not everything is going to be a hit out of the park, but at least it's filling up the space and people are still reading it, I guess. But I would say, not having read any of the older Flash Gordon stuff, I think people might get a better kick out of, like, you know, one of the earlier first or second volumes where you were looking at the stuff from the 1930s and 40s, as opposed to looking at some stuff from the 1960s to get an idea of what was Flash Gordon all about. So I'm going to have to say Death Planet, which I believe is volume 7, is a pass for me. Just if you want to pick it up and look at it, realize that it's super problematic. I'm sure the stuff from the 1930s is problematic as well. I don't want to even get into some of the things that are running through my head right now of how problematic it could be. But this one's just really problematic and doesn't fit with modern thought. Matthew, what are your final thoughts on this?
It is difficult for me to actually articulate an important thing about comic strips to people, in that a comic strip and a comic book are in fact two different things. And when people say, you know, you need to read the Prince Valiants, you need to read the Flash Gordons or the Buck Rogerses, I usually demur because I know that the difficulties of making this serialized stuff really adds up when you're trying to read it as a comic book. And we see that here. I feel like, you know, I remember Flash Gordon when suddenly it was 1942 and he came back to Earth to fight fascists for some reason. You know, I've read a lot of Flash Gordon and I don't think I've ever said to myself, Flash Gordon is really a fave rave for me, with the sole exception of Defenders of the Earth in 1980 Baba Fav. But when you get into this book, I feel like we try to look at things within their own scope. You try to look at something and say, okay, this is 1969, so are they trying for something? Are they trying for representation when they put in the character of Pancho? Or are they just being, you know, unintentionally or maybe even intentionally, you know, racist against Latinx people? And I have to say to myself, does it make a difference in the final analysis? And so I am also a skip on this one. I'm usually a skip on Flash Gordon's. You know, when we did Mandrake, I was a little bit, I was bugged by the same things, but a little bit more engaged. I feel like the only reason to read these particular strips is the beauty of the art, and the art is reproduced small enough that it's hard to even enjoy that. So,
yeah. So here's the thing. We do have a couple of more newspaper collections to read.
Garfield gained weight.
No, both of these are fan requests from our Discord server. So patrons in our Discord server made some requests. So in the coming months, we'll be looking at Rip Kirby. One of the people who was working on Flash Gordon left Flash Gordon to go work on Rip Kirby. So we'll be looking at three stories from some Rip Kirby adventures. And then in the back half of the year, we will also be looking at some Modesty Blaze stuff. Also fan requests. We're going to be doing those a little bit different because one of the things that happens in these Flash Gordon or Mandrake or Steve Canyon stuff that we've read is it's like 5 million pages of comic books, right?
Huge swaths of stuff.
And we're not going to read all of Rick Kirby. We're not going to read all of Modesty Blaze. What we are going to do is we're going to pick three stories or four, depending on who's on the show that week. Each of us will read a different story. And then we will talk and share our thoughts on the particular story. And so that might bring a little bit of a different approach to this because we mostly focused on the Pluto story. We didn't even get to the Death Planet stuff, which was what this collection is supposed to be famous for. So that's how I think we're going to be doing these, the Rip Kirby and Modesty Blaze later in this year, is each of us picking a different book and reading that and then reporting back our thoughts on that. Also Rip Kirby and Modesty Blaze read a lot differently than reading the Flash Gordon or the Steve Canyon stuff that we've done previously. So you got that to look forward to later this year. Mm-hmm. You didn't know what else you have, to look forward to. You can look forward to our pre-show discussion about, Peacemaker, our pre-show discussions about, what was the other thing that I watched? Archive 81. And a whole bunch more. You can only listen to the pre-show if you're a patron at the $5 or higher level. So $5 a month gets you access to the pre-show, flashback podcast, critical hit a week early, character sheets, bonus stuff, all of that over there at our Patreon page. So patreon.com/major spoiler. So go and check that out if you want to get all of that extra stuff. And that's where we're going to wrap it up for this issue. Thank you for listening. Currently, our show is entirely funded by you, our dear, dear patrons. So thank you so much to those of you who back this show.
And if you want to be one of those people, help support us, you can head over to patreon.com/major spoilers, push the button, sign up for your own silver level membership.
You can also support us by using the affiliate links. You can find them at majorspoilers.com.
We'll be back next week. It looks like next week we'll be talking about Birthright Volume 1. Why? Because we know that you love comics. We do too. And we will talk with you soon.
If I had the X-ray vision of a Superman, I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic bookstore guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven rich like a man of iron, I might not be surprised to find that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being the Middle East with a gang sign throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2022 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.